Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A pollution-fighting reservoir, a top priority for Florida's Senate president, is still anything but certain in the Florida House.
We'll go through it. The Senate knows our concerns and what we'd like to do, and so we'll see. But I think that the more the Senate works on it, the happier we are.
Also tonight, accidentally displaying your legally concealed firearm can get you in trouble, even if you're a cop.
I was a peace officer. If I brandished my gun, my first time I got a warning. The second time I got suspended, and I got my gun taken away for 6 months to a year. So why are we making it so easy for people to brandish their guns?
We'll also sit down and have our weekly reporters roundtable and hear from Politico's Jessica Bateman about all the education matters still facing state lawmakers. I'm Tom Flanagan. Just four more weeks to go in the 2017 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Going into this year's legislative session, just about the number one thing atop the wish list of the guy in charge of the Florida Senate was essentially a brand new lake designed to reduce the pollution and resulting algae blooms in his home district. By scaling back the cost and size of that proposed reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, Senate President Joe Negron appears to be making progress with critics. But as Jim Ash reports, a deal is still far from certain.
Memories of a guacamole-like ooze smothering South Florida waterways were still fresh last summer when Senate President Joe Negron proposed a solution, a $2.4 billion 60,000-acre reservoir somewhere south of Lake Okeechobee. Condemnation came swiftly from major landowners like U.S. Sugar and community activists worried about job loss in one of the poorest areas of the state. Debate even spread to North Florida, where former Republican State Senator Greg Evers was running for Congress.
It's time for the state to step up, use the resources that's available to it, and not be purchasing farmland, taking off the tax rolls, making it a burden on the counties south of the lake.
Evers lost, but opposition to the project grew. Negron has been fighting to keep a coalition of Democrats, moderate Republicans, and environmentalists on board ever since. This week, Negron announced he could accomplish the goal with just $1.5 billion and a smaller, deeper reservoir. Senate Budget Chief Jack Latvala says the new plan requires water managers to use far fewer private acres, reducing job loss. And Latvala says that should quiet the critics.
Well, I would certainly hope so. When you hear their stated objections that they've made publicly, it's always had to do with losing jobs or the amount of bonding involved or whatever, and we pretty much removed those stated objections.
Now, the same critics point out the plan would interfere with a complicated schedule for Everglades restoration hammered out years ago between the state and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. But bill sponsor Rob Bradley, a Fleming Island Republican, calls that nitpicking. Bradley says the schedule wasn't written in stone.
What the Senate is saying is that we now have the financial and political wherewithal and will to get Southern Storage done. The schedule should adapt to those realities, and that is the new reality.
The compromise appears to be working. House Speaker Richard Corcoran, a chief critic, told reporters he likes a lot of what he sees.
We'll go through it. The Senate knows our concerns and what we'd like to do, and so we'll see, but I think that the more the Senate works on it, the happier we are.
The new plan delays the need to borrow money for a year, but the state eventually would have to issue bonds to pay its $750 million share of the cost. And that's a line Corcoran says he's not willing to cross.
No, we're not bonding. Bonding's an issue.
There's still bonding in it, so you're going to go along with it, even though it's optional.
No, I didn't say we're going to go along with it. I said it's getting better and better.
Negron is also putting his foot down.
I think we need to have bonding authority in Senate Bill 10 to accomplish the goals in a short period of time.
The money would come from a land acquisition trust fund that was central to Amendment 1. Environmentalists sponsored the ballot initiative in 2014 after the legislature stopped funding land conservation programs like Florida Forever. Over the years, Florida Forever has rescued millions of wilderness acres from the bulldozer. Negron says using Amendment 1 money for the reservoir is a natural fit.
And while we all are entitled to our opinions about bonding and how much we should do, the reality is that Amendment 1, passed by over 70% of the voters, not only authorizes bonding, it anticipates bonding for large land purchases.
In fact, Negron goes a step further. He says Amendment 1 was a mandate for projects like the reservoir.
But when the voters speak and send us a directive to do bonding for environmental land purchases, I think we're obligated to honor that constitutional imperative.
With about a month left in the 60-day session, the project's future looks brighter, but nobody is scheduling a groundbreaking ceremony yet. Governor Rick Scott did not include money for a reservoir in his budget proposal. And like Corcoran, Scott opposes borrowing money for land conservation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
While several gun bills appeared stalled in the Florida Senate, a couple recently passed the House. As Sasha Cordner reports, one gives places of worship attached to a school the authority to allow guns on the property.
Around the country, churches, synagogues, and other places of worship have been attacked in recent years. So Polk City Republican Representative Neil Cumby says worshipers have a right to protect themselves. But he says for those with private schools or similar areas attached, they aren't even allowed to have guests with concealed license permits carry firearms or private security armed with guns on the property.
Under current law, the state legislature, that's us, has effectively made churches gun-free zones if they have a daycare as a part of their house of worship. This is private property, members. We should leave that decision to the folks who own the property.
That's why he authored a bill doing just that, and it passed the House 76-35 with Democrats opposed. But the Senate appears to be going down a different path. Miami Republican Senator Anna Terry Flores, also the Senate President's second-in-command, has already made it known that she isn't in favor of guns on campus or school zones. And she recently amended the Senate version of Cumby's bill to reflect those views.
The intention is to ensure that it wouldn't just be during non-school hours, but also during any school-sanctioned activities. So after school, basketball game or baseball game or whatever it is, that would still be considered a school so that a gun could not be brought on campus during those school-sanctioned activities either.
And that change is not sitting well with the House's Neil Cumby.
Ours is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They were limited to just worship service hours only when school was or an activity was taking place that they would not be exempt. And obviously for some of the mega churches, that doesn't work very well because they have activities going on quite a bit. There's some of those places are like three-ring circuses, so it really would defeat the purpose if we accept that amendment.
Cumby also has another bill that intends to deal with the accidental displays of a firearm by lowering the penalties for violation.
Currently, if a person licensed to carry a concealed firearm temporarily and openly displays to the ordinary sight of another person, it is a second-degree misdemeanor. This bill reduces the penalty from a second-degree misdemeanor to a non-criminal violation with a penalty of $25 payable to the clerk of court for the first violation. If there is a second violation, the fine is $500, also payable to the clerk of court. And if there is a third or subsequent violation, it's a second-degree misdemeanor. So it reverts back to current law.
But Democrats like Aventura Democratic Representative Joe Geller say while they appreciate the bill's intent, the language of the bill needs to be narrowly tailored.
And if it was accidental, inadvertent display is all we were talking about, I would be prepared to be for this bill. I understand the wind can blow your jacket open. I understand you can be reaching for the cornflakes on the top shelf. The problem is the language of the bill. This says temporarily and openly displayed. Doesn't say accidental. It doesn't say inadvertent. It doesn't say by mistake. So if it is a deliberate, temporary, and open display, you can do it under this bill. And I don't think that's what we're here to try to protect.
Still, the measure passed the House 80-34, mostly along party lines, with most Democrats opposed. Meanwhile, its Senate companion has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, our Capitol Report Reporters Roundtable looks back over a week filled with discussion, debate, and disagreement when it comes to issues like gambling and the legislature's ongoing drive to reduce local government's jurisdiction and revenues.
And under this bill, we will lose $7.7 million, so we can't take care of the needs of our own citizens.
And we'll dive deep into education issues and how the Florida legislature might move on those, especially in the realm of cutting back on the testing public school students, teachers, and administrators must endure.
If the Senate really wants these testing changes, then they will try to get them by offering something that the House wants.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
The end of week five of this 2017 Florida lawmaking session. We are past the halfway point, all downhill from here until Sunny Dive, which is scheduled for May 5th. And our Capitol Report Reporters Roundtable convenes once again to go over some of the top things from this week, starting with you, Regan McCarthy.
So we saw a lot of interesting things come up in the legislature this week. I think a lot of the big priorities that we've sort of been watching and expecting to see come to a head are really beginning to do that. One issue that I've been tracking is gambling, and I think we're really beginning to see that move a lot at this point. The House brought its gambling bill onto the floor this week, and while there still remains a big gap between the House proposal and the Senate proposal, the House gambling leadership team did really say that they expected to see some more work happening between those two plans. I believe it was Mike LaRosa, who is sponsoring the House gambling plan. He said he might think that we could see those plans come into conference as early as next week. And conference, of course, is something that we're familiar with seeing lawmakers do with the budget. It's when two teams from each chamber meet together and sort of talk about areas where they might be able to begin to find compromise on an issue. And so we're expecting to maybe see that process happening here with gambling. They do still really seem to be standing apart on the issue of allowing paramutuals that have held a local referendum to offer slot machines. It's something LaRosa has said is a non-starter for the House, but something that Senate President Joe Negron feels very strongly about. And here he is talking a little bit about that.
The voters went to the polls. These are the same voters that elected us. They went to the polls. They know what they're doing. They know what the amendments say, the referendum say. And they have voted to grant their community more gaming opportunities. And it is not the place of the legislature to substitute our judgment for the judgment of voters. That should be given the highest level of respect. And whether we personally agree or disagree with those decisions is immaterial.
Okay, well, one thing you pointed out, Regan, was that there is still some agreement that needs to be forged between House and Senate. When it comes to gambling, there also is a lot of agreement that has to be forged when it comes to matters of the budget and also taxes. And that's where you come in, Nick Evans.
Yeah. So this week we saw two initiatives having to do with the homestead exemption. One of them is pretty straightforward and seems likely to make the 2018 ballot. This one would retain the current cap on the rise in the assessed value of a non-homesteaded property. A long-winded way of saying maintain the status quo. So lawmakers in both chambers seem ready to send this to the ballot. The other one is much, much more controversial. And we go back to Republican Mike LaRosa here. He's pushing forward a measure that is a priority within the House to extend a larger homestead exemption. So right now, you don't pay property taxes on the first $25,000 of assessed value, and then you don't pay property tax on the assessed value between $50,000 and $75,000. What he wants to do is extend that from $75,000 up to $100,000. So based on how state economists have looked at this, they think this is going to cost about $750 million, and that's going to fall heavily on local coffers. Now, this week we had a former lawmaker, Senator Nancy Dietert, come back up because she's now a county commissioner. And she argued, you know, right now what her community needs isn't an extra tax cut. What it needs is money to address things like gridlock. Here she is.
Road improvement. We need a new courthouse. We're trying to do a bike trail for quality of life issues. And under this bill, we will lose $7.7 million, so we can't take care of the needs of our own citizens.
So you can see she's pretty straightforward about the idea that this is going to hurt local governments. And she was echoed by many, many other local officials.
So we're going to have to get some coherence between House and Senate when it comes to these matters, too, because these are not ironed out across the board, right?
You know, it's interesting. The first issue that I mentioned, it appears to be chugging along in both chambers, moving along very, very easily. The Senate, they don't seem to have anything relating to this additional $25,000 that Representative Mike LaRosa is proposing. And keep in mind, once these actually even get to the floor, you have to get 3/5 of the lawmakers in both chambers to agree to it for it to head to the ballot.
Thanks, Nick. Another point of contention now in this very same Capitol report, Sasha Cordner is talking about the possible expansion of gun rights to religious institutions that also have schools attached to them. Kate Payne, you've been following something different, which is the Stand Your Ground modification or putting the burden of proof elsewhere than from where it is now. So what's going on with that?
Sure. So the House this week approved changes to Stand Your Ground, like you mentioned. And of course, that's Florida's pretty infamous self-defense law that allows Floridians to use deadly force if they fear for their lives. And if that force is justified, they can actually avoid prosecution. And so what lawmakers have offered this week is to actually shift the burden of proof from defendants to prosecutors. And so opponents of that are saying this will be easier for folks to claim self-defense in these killings that maybe aren't justified. And opponents say this will basically broaden a license to kill in the state. There's still some disagreement between the House and Senate on how high to stack that burden of proof, and that's something that they'll have to reconcile. But it is worth noting that actually under Florida's Stand Your Ground, we have seen gun homicide rates rise pretty markedly by 31%, according to a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Kate, you've got something going on out in Marianna. And again, Sasha Cordner has been doing a lot of reporting on that relating to the former Dozier School for Boys and apologies. And apparently that's not the only apology that's being made this week.
Yeah. So it's pretty rare that state lawmakers will make these public apologies and acknowledgments for past wrongs, but we're seeing that in two different cases actually right now. So one would be for the victims at the Dozier School for Boys, and there were two branches in Okeechobee and in Marianna as well, and those victims were sexually and physically abused. But lawmakers in both chambers want to establish a memorial for those folks. as well as allocate more money to actually exhume bodies that may have been buried at the site. We're also seeing support for an apology for the Groveland Four. Those were four black men who were accused of raping a white woman in the 1940s. That's another really infamous case that's sort of been catapulted back into the public interest by a book that was published in 2013 that won the Pulitzer Prize. And lawmakers want to offer an apology for those men who were really denied a fair trial. Two were actually killed at the hands of law enforcement, shot to death. Lawmakers want to exonerate the two men who lived to tell the tale and were prosecuted and incarcerated.
Thanks, Kate. Well, we wind up our reporters' roundtable here on Capitol Report with you, Sarah Mueller. What you been following?
Florida sheriffs are pretty upset about this list that the federal government has started putting out. It talks about local jurisdictions that don't cooperate with immigration officials, ICE officers, and Alachua County is actually on one of the reports, and they have no idea why. And they say that they are cooperating with immigration officials, but that there's certain things they can't do. They have to have probable cause. They have to have a warrant signed by a judge in order to keep someone in custody. And so Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri says the warrants ICE is issuing are not constitutional.
We want a solution to this, but continuing this report is not a solution. And visiting sheriffs of Florida and knocking on the doors of sheriff's offices and telling sheriffs, if you don't honor these detainers, we're going to put you on this report, is not the way to do business, and that should stop.
A lot of federal courts have said that detention orders are voluntary, and yet the counties look bad because they're getting put on this list saying that they're not cooperating.
Okay, and that one is probably going to be broiling for quite some time, so we'll be following that. Thanks so much, Sarah Mueller. Also, Kate Payne, Nick Evans, and Regan McCarthy, our Capitol Report Reporters Roundtable. We will see you in week six. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter dives deep on the many education matters still facing this year's edition of the Florida Legislature.
Jessica Bakeman, Politico, thank you so much for joining us here tonight on Capitol Report. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about the education issues that have been unfolding over the past week or two here in the Florida legislature. We have this major testing bill, which sort of got off to a really rocky start, especially over in the Senate. Last week it was temporarily postponed, but this week it started moving. It's really a merger of two different proposals. Talk a little bit about this bill, because it's one that I know a lot of parents are looking at, because it deals specifically with the tests that their students are going to have to take.
In the Senate, there's a bill that I think is very much influenced by Republicans and Democrats there. And it does a few things. It very significantly would cut down on the number of end of course assessments or final exams that are required for some high school courses, specifically U.S. History, Algebra 2, and Geometry. And it does a couple of other things. It pushes the testing window back to the end of the school year in an attempt to give students more time to learn before they have to take the tests. And it makes some changes to the accountability system and the way that teachers are evaluated based on test scores. And so it's controversial in large part because so many of those policies were championed by former Governor Jeb Bush, who, of course, you know, predicated his run for president on his education reform record in Florida. And so there's kind of always a tension in the legislature, in Tallahassee in general, because the governor, the former governor, still has so much of a presence here, where some lawmakers are really trying to preserve his legacy. policy, and they're being encouraged to do that by the foundations that he chairs, including the Foundation for Excellence in Education, while other lawmakers are saying, we're hearing from parents that this is a problem, that maybe this is what we needed before, but we don't need it anymore. And so now we really have to make some changes in order to respond to our constituents who will hold us accountable at the polls.
Probability that this goes through in the House, because that chamber has not amended its companion measures so far to look like the Senate's bill. And obviously that chamber, there are still a lot of members who firmly believe in former Governor Bush's education accountability system.
I think that whether this is successful in the House comes down to basically the same question of whether anything this legislative session is successful, which is, you know, budget negotiations or the final negotiations over so-called trains, which are big bills that include a lot of policy changes that basically are big compromises at the end of the day. If the Senate really wants these testing changes, then they will try to get them by offering something that the House wants. But I'm not sure that the Senate leadership cares enough about these testing issues to make that a big priority.
We saw this week probably one of the most in-depth conversations on failing schools that I've personally seen in the legislature in a very long time. And the issue was this proposal that they're calling Schools of Hope. It would allow essentially charter schools to come in and operate in areas where there are failing public schools. And these are schools that have been failing for 5-10 years. What triggered this legislation? They're asking for $200 million for it. Does it have a future?
Speaker Corcoran has said since he became speaker, and of course before he was speaker, that a top priority is ending what he calls, what he keeps referring to as failure factories, which if any of your listeners read the Tampa Bay Times series about some failing schools in St. Petersburg, that's where he gets that rhetoric. And he thinks that charter schools are the solution. And so his House Education Committees had brought in some national high-performing charter school networks that operate charter schools in other states and brought them into the committees to say, why aren't you in Florida? What can we do to get you to come to Florida? And so he has designed this legislation that's basically a wish list of all of the statutory and regulatory changes that they said would make it more likely for them to come here. However, we'll see what is actually going to come of this. I actually had a story this morning where I talked to several of the charter school organizations that he has mentioned by name. A couple of those, they just don't have any plans to expand in Florida. And the others raised some concerns about whether the proposal that the House has come up with is really consistent with their educational models. So basically, there are just some questions about whether this is actually going to look the way that he wants it to. And I asked him about it yesterday, and I said, what's going to happen to that $200 million if you don't have the interest from these charter school chains that want to come spend it? And he said, it'll be spent.
It'll be spent somehow, some way. Jessica Bakeman with Politico, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us.
I appreciate it.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.